Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we hope you and your loved ones had a very Merry Christmas. A little later in today's show, our news director, Dave Thompson, will share his news year in review. Matt Olin will also review a film he loves, Emilia Perez, and Dr. Tom Ezern will bring us another delightful historical reflection in his Plains Folk essay. But first, Amy Dalrymple is the editor-in-chief of the North Dakota Monitor, which is part of the state's newsroom network. She'll give us an update on the Monitor's first year and also share her insights into the stories that resonated most with her readers during the outlet's first year of operation. Amy, welcome back to Main Street.
Thanks so much for having me.
Amy, we're looking forward to seeing what the top news stories of the year were from your perspective. But before we get into that, refresh us. What is the North Dakota Monitor? What's your goal?
Yeah, well, thanks for the opportunity. The North Dakota Monitor, we just celebrated our first anniversary on December 12th. We are a nonprofit news site dedicated to covering state government in North Dakota. We are affiliated with the national nonprofit States Newsroom, and our goal is to provide free coverage, again, with a focus on state government, but we also cover other topics of statewide interest like education and agriculture and energy. One of the really cool things is that all of our stories are free to be republished by other newspapers or other news outlets. And so our stories do appear really statewide and also throughout the region for people who are interested in North Dakota news.
Give me an idea of your staff, Amy.
Yeah, we started out with a staff of four. Most of us are in Bismarck, but we have one colleague in the Fargo area. About halfway through the year, we got a grant from ProPublica, so we were able to add a fifth person. He is based in Bismarck, where I am, and he focuses more on investigative projects. And he's a one-year grant that we were able to get for his position.
So a year in so far, what do your analytics tell you? Are people reading the North Dakota Monitor?
Yeah, that's what's been really exciting. We have found an audience very quickly and appreciate all the great support we've had throughout the state. I did take a look at what people, you know, what some of our top stories were this year. And of course, in an election year, turns out that our voter guide was at the top of the list. A lot of people were coming to our website to prepare for the election, to be informed. Some of the top, you know, stories that people were really reading related to the election were, of course, the governor's race, where we saw a new governor, Kelly Armstrong, elected. And then a lot of people were interested in the property tax measure that I think will continue to be a discussion point in 2025, even though that measure failed. And a lot of people were coming to our website to read about the proposals related to property tax relief.
Amy, one thing that I found very interesting when I worked at a newspaper back in Wyoming, we looked at analytics, and oftentimes what readers were interested in kind of surprised us versus what we thought was really important. And it was kind of eye-opening for us. At the end of the year, we would do exactly this. You know, what were the most read stories? Here they are. What were the most important stories we felt might be different than what our readers were really clicking on, so to speak? Do you find that too?
Yeah, yeah. There sometimes are some surprises in there. Like one of our top read stories was Measure 2, which was not a real hot topic, but I think people were coming to our site because they wanted to understand what the measure was about before they voted. And so that one did kind of surprise me that it was so high in our analytics. The other story that was really high that does not surprise me was among our top stories was the Ray Holmberg case, the story with him pleading guilty to traveling for sex with children, of course, the former lawmaker. So that story was, you know, several stories related to that were in our top stories. And of course, that's not really surprising.
I feel good that people were looking at you for Measure 2 information. They wanted to be informed. And shoot, there is nothing wrong with that. All right, Amy, let's have you review the top stories of the year from your perspective. Maybe you have about 10 or so for us. You can go from the kind of important to at number 10 to the really top news story of the year from the North Dakota Monitor at number one. So I'll kind of turn it over for you and I'll pop in with questions if I have any.
Okay, great. And I don't know that I am qualified to to give a ranking, because I think it's really subjective
what
interests you. But certainly I just named a couple. You know, the election was a big one throughout the year. And of course, a lot of that was actually in June with the primary, where we saw the heated primary in the governor's race between Kelly Armstrong and Tammy Miller. And then there were also a lot of legislative races in June that were interesting, with challenges against Republican incumbents, with incumbents, you know, overwhelmingly winning election, but there were some interesting races there. And then, of course, the U.S. House race was another one that was a big race, especially in June, when Julie Fedorchuk won in a five-way primary. And then, as I previously mentioned, the ballot measures were also really hot topics in 2024, especially that property tax measure, which, even though it failed, is still top of mind for a lot of voters and going to be a continuing topic in 2025.
Are there stories that are just on the cusp, do you think? A lot of it, of course, is going to depend on what the legislature makes a priority. But I think of things like the teacher shortage that we've heard about, the childcare shortage that we've heard about, the housing shortage that we've heard about, the worker retention, wanting to have more maybe foreign workers or immigrant workers in the state from the Office of Legal Immigration. Are there any of those stories that were top on your radar?
Oh, absolutely. All of those stories were highly read, and especially as it relates to workforce. And we did cover a lot of the discussion related to the teacher retention task force. And the teacher shortage was definitely top of mind for a lot of readers. Another story that I would say would be really high on the list for the top of the year would be the Summit Pipeline. That, of course, has seen a lot of twists and turns, but ultimately the North Dakota Public Service Commission approved the North Dakota siting permit for that project. And then recently, the Industrial Commission also approved the storage plan, but that still is facing a lot of legal challenges, and there's still a permit decision in South Dakota. So that was a big story in 2024, and I expect will still be one next year.
When there's other stories that are happening, like the wildfires comes to my mind, that are certainly huge stories for North Dakota, it may not be right in your zone of what you want to cover day in and day out with state government. What do you guys think about relative to stories like that?
Sure. We did cover the wildfires. You know, that was a very big story, and it did involve government, because a lot of government agencies responded. One of the stories that we wrote about was highlighting the steps that the energy industry took during that time of extreme fire risk, and also the preliminary causes of a couple of the fires that did point to natural gas flaring contributing to those fires.
Governor Burgum, of course, is now leaving North Dakota for Washington. What's your role in following him, since he will apparently be a combined interior energy cabinet member in President Trump's cabinet? He's now doing work for the federal government, but he is North Dakota's former governor. What do you see North Dakota Monitor's role in kind of keeping up with Doug Burgum?
Yeah, well, one of the other aspects of the North Dakota Monitor is that we do work with D.C. Bureau for States Newsroom. So we do have colleagues who are reporting from D.C., and so we will be able to lean on them for some coverage. But we'll also be monitoring what steps he's taking that will impact North Dakota energy, North Dakota tribes, North Dakota's national park. You know, there's a lot of things that Interior does that are of high interest to North Dakota residents. So we'll certainly be covering that. And also we'll be watching to see exactly what his role, his energy role, is going to be, and how that new National Energy Council, how that will kind of shape out.
Amy, define what your role is with colleges in the state. And I speak of that with a story that's right now as we speak on your website, with the somewhat surprising of Bismarck State College's president, with the turmoil in the presidency of Dickinson State College. What is your role relative to colleges and universities in the state?
Yeah, well, we do cover the State Board of Higher Education, and that used to be a beat when I was a reporter several years ago. And so it is a priority for me that we cover the higher ed system, because it affects our whole state. And you're right, there are going to be a lot of changes with some leadership positions with the Bismarck State College separation agreement that was just approved for that president, the Dickinson State, as you mentioned. The chancellor also is leaving his position, and I'm sure there's going to be a search soon for that position. And also the Lake Region State College president has announced that he is retiring. So we will be covering, you know, that board and watching as they pursue these searches.
Amy, are there any tribal stories that really came to the top of your radar during the year or that you plan to follow in 2025?
Yeah, we went to Standing Rock on Election Day and wrote a story that I thought was interesting about, you know, just voter access and the challenges of voting in an area where there's only one polling place open on Election Day. And if you don't have a vehicle, that's a real barrier to voting. And there were some interesting steps that different groups took to try to encourage people to use the mail-in voting and help facilitate some absentee voting so that more people participated in the election.
If you and I meet together 1 year from today, Amy, what do you think we're going to be talking about?
Oh, that's a tough question. You know, I think we probably will be looking back at what happened in the 2025 legislative session. I think, you know, that will be probably the top story of next year. Hopefully we can say they solved the property tax frustrations. Like, that would be amazing. But that, you know, that's a pretty tall order for the legislature with such a complex issue.
I asked our news director this question, Amy, and I'll ask you. Oftentimes when I covered Wyoming's legislature, I could tell if this was going to be an amicable session or if there was going to be a lot of tension in the session just coming in. How do you feel today? Here we are in December. The session starts in January. Is this going to be a nice session, or is this going to be some tension in the session here with the legislature?
Well, I think there's always some tension just because there's a lot of tough decisions that need to be made in a short amount of time. I think there's going to be a fair amount of a learning curve in this session because we do have a number of newer lawmakers and a lot of lawmakers are going to be leaving because of term limits soon. And so I think there's going to be a lot of effort to try to help the newer lawmakers become more involved and more experienced.
Is that something the legislators have talked about to you, maybe off the record, in Wyoming? I think that's a big issue on what turnover happens, how much it happens, and the institutional memory that's now lost with term limits. Is that a concern of legislators that you visited with?
Yeah, it is. And we've done some reporting on that. They're really trying to be strategic to try to help new members get up to speed more quickly. And I think they appointed some vice chairs with kind of that in mind to try to help accelerate the leadership growth of some of these lawmakers who in the past they might not have been in a leadership position until they had several sessions under their belts, but now they're going to be asked to serve in leadership positions a lot sooner. And so I think they are really thinking about that and trying to be strategic. To refresh listeners' memory, the term limits measure, which was approved by voters, that now limits lawmakers to serving 8 years in each chamber.
Amy, what do you make about the turnover at the Department of Health in state government? Kelly Armstrong's already made a new cabinet-level pick here.
Yeah, I think it's you know, kind of to be expected that a new governor is going to come in and make some changes. And that, you know, that's a very large department. So I think a lot of people are going to be interested to see how that all shakes out. He's indicated that he might restructure that a bit. But I think there's a lot more that we don't know yet about how that's going to look. But I do think that that's going to be probably one area that he might make some structural changes compared to what Governor Burgum had in place.
Amy, before I let you go, I want to ask you, what do you think your role is relative to opinion? All of us who subscribe to newspapers forever are used to an opinion page. Oftentimes with new online presence, some news sites have, opinion is kind of blended or even kind of not even part of what we see and read each day. What's your role relative to an opinion page?
Yeah, that's a great question. On our site, we do have a commentary section, and everything that we publish that's commentary is clearly labeled. And so that's separate from our news stories. I guess my approach has been to focus more on news because I think that's what the need is in our state, to just provide people the facts and help them make up their own minds about what they think. But it, the commentary is section is something that I hope to expand and to look for some more contributors. And I also hope to be writing some more commentary as well. So I do think that there's a role, but I think it's very important to keep it labeled appropriately and to keep the news separated from the commentary section.
Amy, before we go, do people misinterpret what the North Dakota Monitor is all about relative to how you're funded? Do they think you're getting governmental support when you're really not, that you really are reader supported?
I guess I'm not sure what people think, but thanks for the opportunity to shed some light on that. We are supported by readers, and we appreciate all the generous contributions we've received. Our website is NorthDakotaMonitor.com, and there is a link at the top if people want to donate. We are a nonprofit, and our donations to us are tax deductible. We also have a newsletter that comes out 6 days a week, although we are taking a pause until January 2nd, but that comes out 6 days a week that people can subscribe for free, and that's at NorthDakotaMonitor.com/subscribe.
And I'll also note, to read your site, it is free. There's no registration required. People can review any story they'd like to review just by clicking on it.
Correct. Yep. There's no paywall. There's no registration required.
Amy Dalrymple, she's the editor-in-chief of the North Dakota State's newsroom outlet, North Dakota Monitor. And she was previously, of course, the editor of the Bismarck Tribune and a newspaper journalist in Williston and Fargo. Amy, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Thank you so much for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Creative Kitchen, offering a selection of tools for baking, gadgets for cocktails, cheeses for charcuterie, and carving, steak paring, and chef's knives for holiday cooking. Creative Kitchen, located at West Acres in Fargo.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. In another of his Plainsfolk essays, Dr. Tom Ezern captivates us with exploring the curious superstition of water witching, a practice that even intrigued a skeptical U.S. Geological Survey scientist in the early 20th century.
It was the business of the United States Geological Survey in the progressive era of the early 20th century to provide authoritative answers to public questions. Science reigned in those days, or so the scientists thought. And yet, despite their best efforts, people kept sending in fool questions about water witching or dousing. The agency finally assigned one of its best and brightest, a young hydrologist named Arthur J. Ellis, to debunk the business of dousing once and for all. Ellis, born in Kansas in 1885, died of appendicitis in 1920, but not before establishing himself as a scientist's scientist, writing dry-as-dust reports such as groundwater in Musselshell and Golden Valley counties of Montana. Still, and most any serious researcher will confirm this, the best investigator can be captured by his subject. That happened to Ellis when his agency superiors put him on the case of water witching. His lengthy report, dating from 1917, his best-known published work, it turns out, is The Divining Rod, A History of Water Witching. In the preface, the author's supervisor, O.E. Meinzer, expresses satisfaction that Ellis is laying to rest this curious superstition responsible for a large number of inquiries received each year by the United States Geological Survey. Not so fast there. Did you even read the report, Mr. Meinzer? Because I have, and in my reading, young Ellis is having a grand time digging up the origins of dousing, exposing the unscientific nature of the practice, but nevertheless acquiring a not-so-grudging affection for dowsers and their defenders. The origin of the divining rod is lost in antiquity, we read. But Ellis proceeds to track the emergence of dowsing among German miners searching for valuable ores in the 1600s. He recounts its introduction to Britain by German miners. When dowsing appeared in Cornwall during Elizabethan times, Everywhere it aroused controversy, Ellis says. He goes on to detail the investigations of multiple authorities who have attempted to explain how dowsing works, or seems to. They largely concur with one authority of 1883 who concludes that it is the students of psychology and biology, not of geology and hydroscopy, and the science of ore deposits, who can probably consider it. Then there is the work of an Irish investigator of 1891, however, who credits the action of the peach branch or other dowsing rod to unconscious muscular action that may, just might be, he says, due to a subconscious perceptive power commonly called clairvoyance. Thus, during the settler era on the Great Plains, water witching still had literate defenders along with countless practitioners abroad on the land. You may know some water witches, as I do. I know dowsers who find groundwater, but also can locate buried water lines or human bodies. I've even known doodlebuggers who could witch petroleum, although I've always wondered why none of them were rich. I don't spend a lot of time worrying about the science or lack of it. So as a folklorist, I'm happy to welcome Mr. Ellis of the Geological Survey to the dark side, where we delight in human phenomena like water witching for the persistent curiosity and sheer enchantment of the enterprise. The older I get, the more I think maybe we don't have to know everything.
That was our dear friend, Dr. Tom Ezern, a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Coming after the break, Dave Thompson, our news director, looks back on this year in North Dakota news, and Matt Olean will stop by the Main Street studio. He'll review the movie Emilia Perez. That's after this.
Did you know that when you support Prairie Public's radio service starting as little as $5 a month, you'll receive access to one of our best Prairie Public member benefits, PBS Passport. Passport lets you stream your favorite PBS shows on your Roku, Fire Stick, Apple TV, or Smart TV. Watch the programs you love all on your own time. Unlock entire seasons of programs early and discover new TV series, movies, and musical performances all available to you when you support Prairie Public, your local NPR and PBS station.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Gather round everybody, I'm gonna tell you a story.
There's that music we listen to each and every Thursday. Dave, I hope you had a great Christmas.
I did, Craig. How about you?
We had a good Christmas and lots of family in town. We're going to review the year in North Dakota news and have you walk us through Prairie Public's top 10 news stories. Dave, would you say this was a normal news year, an over-the-top news year with the elections? How do you classify this year?
I'm going to say slightly over the top with the elections and also some of the tragedies that happened. For example, that wildfire, and we'll talk about that later.
All right. The top 10 list. I feel like we're Dave Letterman here and I should have some drum rolls or something. But in at number 10 on your list is the new natural gas pipeline that's in the works to bring Bakken natural gas to eastern North Dakota.
And this came right at the end of the year. It just happened this week, as a matter of fact. There was an announcement at the monthly director's cut briefing that WBI Energy of Bismarck is planning to build a line from just near Watford City to Fargo, and they are having what they call an open season to gauge interest about it. It's going to be a fairly long pipeline, but it's going to bring a lot more natural gas. We're talking about 760 million cubic feet of natural gas will travel that line and will be for customers in eastern North Dakota. Now, what WBI needs is to have customers are going to be ready to commit to use the natural gas. Once they get that, then construction can start. It probably will take a while to get it constructed, but at least there's some opportunity to get natural gas to the valley.
Dave, number 9 was an effort that launched to provide free breakfast and lunch. That's for all North Dakota students, K-12. There's a need, and there's an issue with food insecurity. This tries to help.
Absolutely, it does. And the proponents of this say, you know, kids need food to learn. That's one of their PowerPoints on this. And they said, we've got the money, and let's help out the agriculture industry and help out our students who are learning by providing free breakfasts and lunch at school. Minnesota already does that, so North Dakota would do the same thing. It failed in the last legislative session, but narrowly failed, and they think that they may be able to get it over the finish line this time.
Is there a big cost with this, Dave? Is that why it failed?
Well, part of it was cost, because it's a little over $100 million. But what really was concerning was, should the legislature mandate that schools do this? They worry about loss of home, you know, having meals at home. But that can be overcome, I think.
There's certainly a stigma for some that are concerned about this issue with that child getting free lunch. Look at that child getting free lunch, et cetera, versus just providing for everyone.
Right. That is correct, too. As I said, there is money in the bank to do it.
Dave, number 8 on your top 10 news stories of 2024 list. Chaos, you say, at the state GOP convention that was held in Fargo earlier in the year.
Mm-hmm.
You're wondering whether it can lead to some changes in how candidates are chosen?
Well, here's what happened. The Republicans met in Fargo, and in most of the races, they chose candidates that didn't go on to win in the primary. And there's been more and more of an emphasis about maybe going to the primary anyway. Julie Fedorchuk went to the primary. Kirsten Baszler went to the primary, that type of thing. And they're saying, well, maybe we just ought to do this in primaries and just not have a convention that's an endorsing convention at all. That was talked about at the convention because of what happened there when they started first to disqualify the Dickinson delegation from District 37, and then the whole chaos whether or not Rick Becker was going to disrupt the flow of the balloting by saying, people, why don't you write my name, and then you have a spoiled ballot, and then nobody gets a majority of the votes cast. So there were a lot of things going on at that convention, and there's going to have to be some interior introspective look on what happened.
What's the timeline, Dave? Do you think that this might be examined by the state GOP?
Well, if it isn't, there may be legislation that would say, okay, we're not going to do endorsing conventions, and we'll just go to the primary anyway. I know there's some talk among legislators about that.
Dave, number 7 on your list, another pipeline issue. This is a little different, though. This is the Summit pipeline that's been permitted, but legal action now continues. This is a carbon capture pipeline from ethanol plants.
Right, ethanol plants in the upper Midwest, including Tharaldson Ethanol. That's out in Castleton. What they would do is take the CO2 to a place where Morton-Oliver County, you know, intersect, and they have sites to place this carbon dioxide under the ground. There's some concern among the pipeline route that Summit is not treating people fairly. There's also some concern that they don't think it's going to work. And some counties have tried to put their own ordinances in, but that was struck down by the North Dakota Public Service Commission, says the local ordinances cannot oversee state laws on this. And the Industrial Commission has given the final permit for these underground storage sites. So it isn't going to start construction next week because Summit still has to get some approval from South Dakota regulators to get it to happen.
Dave, we're moving up the list. We're reviewing the top stories from the Prairie Public News Department in 2024. As we speak, and this is very fluid right now, we still have yet to have a farm bill. This is number six.
That is correct. There is efforts to, you know, do another extension of the farm bill and work on it when the new Congress gets in session. It's also been tied up in the back and forth over a continuing resolution to keep the government open. And there's all sorts of things at play here. I know that they would like to do more with the farm bill, but they may end up, and I'm thinking that that's what everybody's thinking, there will be another extension of the farm bill, and they'll have a go out of the next congressional session.
Dave, number 5 on your list, something that I've heard about from the moment I moved here to North Dakota about 2.5 years ago. This is the issue of housing and child care shortages that really impacts the recruitment, and I'll add the retainment of workers.
Absolutely. The legislature has done some things in terms of childcare, the childcare advocates and the people who want to move here say that we need more to be done. There's all sorts of stories out there about people wanting to come to Ellendale, but they don't have enough childcare slots. So there's going to be some efforts in the next legislative session to do something with that. And of course, housing is always very critical, and affordable housing is really critical right now. So there are efforts that are going to be spearheaded by the North Dakota Housing Finance Agency, the Bank of North Dakota, to get more affordable housing into some of these areas so workers can move there and take the jobs.
That will be an issue, I'm sure, that will be front and center.
I believe.
Along with another issue we're going to talk about in just a moment in the 2025 legislative session. Our governor, Governor Burgum, ran for president, Dave, and kind of sought the vice presidential slot, didn't get that. Now he likely will receive a cabinet post. That was number four on your list.
It was number four on my list because it really was really fascinating to watch because we are not used to in North Dakota having somebody who actively campaigns for president. And he did. He tried to get the nomination, failed, and then he tried to maybe put himself in a possible VP candidate, and now he's been nominated for Department of the Interior. So it'll be interesting to see. I think this is going to be also a developing story to see what happens with the Burgum nomination.
Dave, let's move up the list. Number three, there's more demand for electricity from data centers here in North Dakota, and then new power infrastructure to support that need and our current need is pending.
Right. New power lines, new power generation. There's some talk about, earlier we talked about nuclear power, and that is one thing that was suggested that maybe these smaller nuclear plants might provide power for these data centers. And even Governor Armstrong has said, hey, data centers are great for North Dakota because we've got the climate for it, because you need cooling in these data centers. The trouble is there going to be a point where the electricity might be reach a bottleneck and maybe some homeowners might not have the electricity if data centers are using a lot of it. That has not happened yet, but there's some concern that it might. So we'll have to look at what might be some solutions. And at the same time, the Midwest Independent System Operator, MISO, which is the transmission authority for the upper Midwest states, has gone with a big number of projects to increase electric generation and strengthen the power grid.
The wildfires that sprung up in western North Dakota.
It was a big issue because you had tinder dry conditions, drought conditions, and then you had these strong winds. And apparently fires may have been started by flaring of natural gas. That's what one report has said from the fire marshal's office. And that spread very quickly across this tinder dry grass. It destroyed cropland. It took a couple of animals' lives, and actually two people died in it, in the wildfires. And now the area is trying to recover. There are recovery funds that are coming from a number of sources, including FEMA, and also an effort by the North Dakota Stockmen's Association to raise some money for farmers who may have lost cattle or lost some of their equipment or barns or anything like that in these flames. So we'll have to see that. That's still a story in progress because the region is still trying to recover from that.
Should be of no surprise to anybody. Your top story of 2024 was property taxes.
Right.
Of course, there was Measure 4 that was defeated by the electorate here in North Dakota. The new governor, Governor Armstrong, legislators, if you visit with them, they all want property tax reform legislation. It's been an issue long before now, but it was big issue this year.
Was a big issue this year, and there were some people who thought that Measure 4 might pass. The flaw with Measure 4 that everybody was pointing out, there was no definite way in that measure to replace the money that local governments will lose if property taxes goes away. So Armstrong is looking at it this way. He says property taxes are necessary, but we need to get some control over how they're raised, and maybe the idea of caps has been floated. I know that's been floated by the Senate Majority Leader. There will be a meeting between now and the beginning of the session between the governor and legislative leaders to talk about what happens now, because there are 50-plus bills that have been introduced, that will be introduced in the legislative session. They want to get it down to maybe one, two, or three bills that will really address keeping some lid on property taxes.
Dave, I wish you a very happy new year.
Thank you so much, Craig. You too.
You betcha. Thank you so much for bringing the news to us here across the state pretty much each and every day. I wish that our listeners could see how hard you work, and I really appreciate what you do for us here at Prairie Public, Dave. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Craig. Appreciate it.
A quick update to Dave's number six story of the year. Last Friday, Congress extended the 2018 Farm Bill for another year as part of its last-minute spending package to avert a government shutdown. There's our fanfare. That means it's time for our movie review, one of the last ones of the year. Madeline, welcome back to Main Street.
Hi, Craig.
All right, Matt, this is a film, a French musical crime comedy. I don't usually associate musicals and crime comedies together. Let's listen to the trailer of Emilia Perez, and then we'll come back and talk about the movie.
Are you English?
No. No, I'm not English.
Why? No, because you you are pretty.
So? Does your client have a name?
He desires to remain anonymous. If you're not willing to accept, I don't think it's worth talking. Just cut to the chase. To listen is to accept.
Matt, we've heard the trailer. How effectively does the movie blend these genres, I guess, of musical, crime, thriller, melodrama?
I think it does it pretty well. Jacques Audiard is the director. He's a French director. His most famous films to Americans would be Rust and Bone with Marion Cotillard, and also A Prophet, which was up for the foreign language Oscar. He's a 72-year-old French filmmaker, but this film is basically in Spanish. Set in Mexico and other places. And it's an audacious film. It was a big success at the Cannes Film Festival. I think it's going to be a big Oscar success as well, from what I'm kind of hearing through the grapevine. It's already got a bunch of Golden Globe nominations. Every year, Craig, we get one of these movies that just gets polar extremes, right? Poor Things last year. Poor Things divided people. Power of the Dog in 2021. Completely. I had friends that hated it. People that loved it. I think this is going to be one of those movies, if people ever see it in theaters, and I got a free screener in the mail, that's going to divide them. So it is a musical. There's a lot of singing and dancing that goes on in this movie that goes with kind of this Sicario Dog Day Afternoon plot. It's kind of a combination of Sicario, Dog Day Afternoon, and kind of just a crazy over-the-top musical. The basic story is Zoe Saldana plays this lawyer who is hired by a drug kingpin, a cartel kingpin, played by Carla Sofia Gascon, to effectively transition him into becoming a woman, which will, basically that's what he wants to do, but also it will forever, you know, change his identity and keep him protected from, you know, people that want to kill him. That's the plot. I like this movie a lot. It dragged a little bit, I thought, in the middle, but it has a great ending. Selena Gomez plays his long-suffering wife, who has no idea what's going on in terms of the transition surgery. There's a marvelous musical number at the clinic where he's going to undergo the surgery, and there's nurses and doctors dancing around and singing. It all sounds ridiculous, right, Craig, when I explain it to you? Audiard kind of pulls it off. I think for the most part, he pulls it off. It's not my favorite film of the year, but it's certainly in the top 10, and the cinematography is great. You really get a sense of these two characters. Saldana is really good in this role. She's going to be Oscar-nominated. But the person that carries this movie is Carla Sofia Gascon, who is a transgender actress from Mexico, certainly going to get an Oscar nomination. This could be a groundbreaking nomination, right, Craig? A transgender actress in the Best Actress mix up against Cynthia Erivo and Mikey Madison from Anora and other people I expect to be nominated. It's not really a film about transgender identity. It's really a film about kind of taking control of one's life and doing better things. So without getting into too much plot detail, you will see the transformation of this character, the drug kingpin, who becomes Emilia Perez. That is his new name when he becomes a transgender woman. And it's a little long, I thought, in spots. It's going to be polar extremes. I think people will hate this film and people will love it, but I do expect it could break a record for most Oscar nominations for a foreign language movie. So it's going to be in the Best Picture mix, also in the foreign language film, international feature film, they call it now, mix. So yeah, it's crazy. It's out there. Saldana and Gascon are so good in this movie. Going to be interesting to see, Craig, where they put them in the actress, lead actress versus supporting actress, or if they're both in the lead category. They both feel like they're co-leads in this movie. But as I've told you, in modern times, last 30 years or so, to kind of not have their people competing against each other, they will stick probably Saldana in supporting actors, which makes no sense when you watch the movie. It'll be the strangest movie you ever see this year if you see it.
Matt, you talk about that this is a polarizing film, and I've just got to ask for what you've read about the movie. Is it going to be a conservative versus progressive type of person that's going to be encouraged not to go to this movie or to go to this movie, or is it going to stay away from all of that noise?
That's a good question. I didn't see it that way, Craig. I think the polar extremes are going to come from people that watch this and say, this is ridiculous. It's about a drug kingpin and they're dancing around singing. I think that's going to be, I've met people all through my life who just can't separate. They can't accept that you're watching a movie. Everything has to be realistic to them. And it's, you know, it's hard to talk movies with folks like that. I get it. That's your opinion. Not your opinion, Craig. I'm saying people that I've talked to about this. My dad was like that. He could never separate reality from, he hated musicals, you know, because people don't, you know, street gangs don't sing like in West Side Story. But there's a theatrical element that Orson Welles talked about. You're watching a movie, you understand that the movie isn't real, but it has to be true. Some part of it has to be true. And I think Gascon's performance is what makes this movie, along with Saldana's performance. And so I think if you just go in with an open mind and understand there's going to be some action scenes, there's going to be some singing and dancing, and there's going to be some uncomfortable things for some people to watch in terms of the transgender surgery and things that are going on with Emilia Perez's character. So I don't know if it's going to be a progressive versus conservative thing on this movie like some movies maybe are. I think it's going to be more, will you accept that you're watching a movie about a drug kingpin where people sing and dance as well?
In the end, Matt, this is a movie about redemption, isn't it?
Yes, it is, for sure. Because, again, without getting into too much detail as to the character that you're watching initially in the movie, you're watching a man, right, who's a drug kingpin. It is about redemption. It's about connecting with children. It's about connecting with people that are down in their luck, that need help finding people, finding missing people. The transformation that Emilia Perez goes through with her character transformation is pretty amazing. So when you watch it from that perspective, it's really an amazing performance. She could win the Best Actress Oscar. I think it's possible. I think it's between her and Cynthia Erivo in Wicked. That's who I think it's going to come down to.
Let's jump to the Oscar part of our discussion here today, Matt. It's Christmas time, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a Wonderful Life is a well-known Christmas movie. Many of us watch it each and every year. Our family is one of them. Some of our family likes it, others don't. But
who doesn't like that? Who doesn't like that movie?
I have
really?
To not tell.
Okay. Wow. That's a first.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
However, I will say it was nominated for an Academy
Award.
Did it win? If it didn't, which movie won that year?
So it was up for Best Picture, but The Best Years of Our Lives, which is an amazing movie, got Best Picture. Jimmy Stewart was also up for Best Actor, but he lost to Frederick March in The Best Years of Our Lives.
We've been to the movies with Matt Olean. Matt, Happy New Year.
You too.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Dakota Datebook for December 26th. Mail delivery was a sporadic and unreliable system in the 18th century, both irregular and limited. The United States did not have a government postal service until 1847. Transatlantic service became more reliable with the advent of steamships, which were more dependable than sailing ships. But it took time to develop a truly reliable system. Steamships could deliver mail to the West Coast, but settlers on the Great Plains needed to feel connected to the rest of the country. To address this, Congress provided financial incentives to stagecoach lines to create and maintain mail routes in the new territories. In 1858, Waterman Ormsby wrote to the New York Herald about traveling on a stagecoach that carried the mail. He wrote, "The cry of 'All aboard' and the merry crack of young John Butterfield's whip denoted that we were off. We rode along at a somewhat rapid pace because John Jr. was determined that the overland mail should go through his section on time. I must confess, it was a matter of astonishment to me how the driver ever found his way in the darkness." Transatlantic mail in particular was problematic. It ran into a bottleneck upon entering the country, as foreign mail was screened in New York City. From there, it was parceled out to other hub post offices like Chicago, and from there to even smaller post offices. The postal system was crucial in keeping settlers on the frontier connected to the rest of the country. Newspapers helped keep the frontier informed of national news, and the mail also served to keep families connected. With so many immigrants on the Great Plains, transatlantic mail from family members still in Europe was always welcome. On this date in 1912, the post office announced a change that would ease the delivery of transatlantic mail. Instead of being screened in New York, mail destined for the Great Plains would be shipped directly to St. Paul. This change would decrease delays, especially during Christmas, and enhance the importance of St. Paul as a commercial hub. George Washington envisioned a nation united by a system of post roads and post offices. As the system developed, the post office played an important role in binding the nation together. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you so much for joining us on Main Street here on Prairie Public. Tomorrow, tune in at 3 p.m. Central for Jeremy Hobson's The Middle, where he'll ask, now start shaking your heads, yes, are you addicted to your phone? Then at 7 p.m., catch Science Friday with Ira Flatow. We'll be back here on Monday for another edition of Main Street.